Sanji Saturday, April 21st, our house guests, the Odoms and the Negleys, left too early for me to visit with them, but I had the satisfied feeling that I'd made them happy. Much of the day was business, talking with Don Thomas, a trip to the dentist, dictating with Peggy and Ashton, a picture in the yellow oval room to send to two special friends, and then at 4 o'clock, the most interesting point of the day, Alice Roosevelt Longworth came to tea and brought her grandchild, Joanna Sturm. She's fiercely undaunted by old age, bristling with a quality of aliveness. A very interesting woman. It's said of her that she has an acid tongue, but I like her as well as finding her highly interesting. We reminisced over tea, and obviously she enjoyed herself. In recalling the days that she spent in the house, she said once her little half-brothers and their friends were playing hide-and-seek in the attic, what is now the third floor, and that President Roosevelt, hearing the noise, went upstairs to investigate. It was nighttime, and he was in his pink pajamas, rotund and blustering. One of the youngsters looked up and said, "Here comes Cupid!" She told her she had had her appendix out in the Queen's room, lying there on the bed the doctor brought from Baltimore. Then she was moved into what's now the Lincoln Room to recuperate. She said her stepmother had 3 good party dresses, and since the press was not present at their receptions and entertainments, but instead they gave out a description of them, she would describe a dress for one reception as blue-gray silk, and for the next as light blue moire silk with a lace portrait collar, and so on and so on. The same dress, described in different ways. She had not, however, enjoyed having dates in the White House. She had always gone out to a dear aunt's who lived here in town, where she felt freer. Linda was with us and enjoyed talking to her and bringing out stories of the past. I knew so much about the history of that day. It was very pleasant to see how Mrs. Longworth was enjoying herself. This had been planned especially for her grandchild, but I think perhaps both she and I enjoyed it more. A slight rise of the hall as you pass the Treaty Room and approach the Lincoln Room, I had always thought was a sort of an architectural mistake, just something that happened in the course of many renovations. No, she said, she thought it had been put in there to accommodate President FDR's wheelchair, a ramp of sorts, because there had been a step there in times past. We had a detailed trip through all the second floor and all the first floor, and 2 hours of reminiscing on the treasures of this house, both in furnishings and in stories of human beings. When she left, I dashed over to the West Wing for a long-deferred meeting with Mrs. Smith, Jim Ketchum, and Miss Linky about the fish room, our floundering project, and the President's small office. And then, in a rush to dress for the Italian embassy and the return engagement of Prime Minister Moreau. These receptions, intended in the most gracious manner, are a piece of madness that go under the name of a social function. The painted 18th century doors of the Italian embassy and its rainbow-hued Venetian glass chandeliers were completely obscured in the welter of humanity through whom we pressed Ambassador Fennie Oltea, Lyndon, Prime Minister Moreau, Mrs. Fennie Oltea, and me, with the photographers in stumbling retreat in front of us and friends on each side getting a hurried greeting, or in the case of Virginia Rusk, back to the wall by the crowds, a kiss from Lyndon. The whole affair takes little more than 30 minutes. Prime Minister Moreau is an amiable, earnest man. One likes him, but a reception is no format to learn anything about him or his country. Back at the White House, I changed into my green chiffon evening dress to go to the Pan American Union to see an art exhibit of paintings by young artists from all over South America, sponsored by Esso. Harry and Clayton McPherson took me. Ambassador Moreau met me at the front door, along with the Jamesons of Esso, saw the receiving line, and we inevitably formed an entourage. How odd there should be no realism in the lot, only one out of about 30 exhibits, a still life of a plate of fruits. Otherwise, the paintings were way out, expressionistic, or perhaps surrealistic is the word. Some mood pictures, even satire. Some beautiful arrangements of coloring. Some grotesque, weird, searching, so that you wondered about the generation of artists who painted them. What is their world like, if this is the way they see it? There's little communication between me and them. And the sculpture. Once more, nothing recognizable. There was even one piece that squawked. I applaud the efforts of an industry in an underdeveloped country, sponsoring and helping young artists, but I cannot for the life of me understand the work of most of the young artists. Lyndon had invited the Max Fried fans to join us for dinner, and by the time I reached home, they were there. And I had the luxury of a quiet visit just with Max before Lyndon arrived. And then the conversation revolved around him. Lyndon brought George McGee just over from Germany for a few days with him. And the conversation was good. I asked George about the possibility of a united Europe, a feeling that I had sensed was in the air when I'd been to the Scandinavian countries and to the Benelux countries in the fall of 63. Apogee of that time is past, George thinks, the goal having effectively prevented it. Germany is a crucial country, and Germany is still willing, but no longer anxious, and the time for it to happen diminishes day by day. Lyndon took his text on Vietnam, and in vivid earthy language, very clear, quite impressive, summarized our positions vis-a-vis Vietnam and the 10-year course of the struggle. I knew he was working. I knew he wanted to explain it from his viewpoint to Max, and maybe Max in turn, by osmosis, would explain it to his readership. He's been hammering away this last month on TV, in press conferences, to individual columnists, to groups of congressmen, to every forum he meets, trying to put Vietnam in true perspective to win the war of words, we have faltered even more so than on the battlefield itself. When you're right up so close to the scene, it's hard to tell when something starts, but I believe I've seen it start these last few weeks, a seizing of the offensive, not only with planes and gunfire in Vietnam, but here at home in telling about it, in convincing people.